Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right, right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Right now.
This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. We had some technical difficulties with this particular show, which really distorted the sound. So I am having to redo at least the first part of the radio program. I'm going to introduce Barbara Smith. Barbara Smith has been a warrior on many different fronts. She is one of the co-founders of the Combahee River Collective. She also was a founder of the Kitchen Table Women of Color Press. She has written several books. She is a speaker. She is a thought leader. She is a strategist. She is a former elected official. So you can see she used a lot of different battlefields to fight the good fight. I want to welcome her and also start off with this question. Tell us a little bit about how the Combahee River Collective statement, or the collective itself, was created, and where did the statement evolve from? And then why do you think that statement has had such enduring legacy when it comes to Black feminism?
Well, thank you, Jamala, for starting off with such a rich first question. The Combahee chapter of the National Black Feminist Organization, and the National Black Feminist Organization was founded in 1973 by Sister Bella Smith and then Black feminists, including Shirley Chisholm,
and
raised by Southerners from Georgia, but I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Intentionality, because sometimes people change or do stuff that you may not want to lift up, 10, 20, 30 years later, but a action. He kind of knows that she did it over a few years, but this one is pretty phenomenal.
Culminate with the raid on the Combahee River, and you can imagine how I felt sitting in the theater and sitting there. There's a new book that came out, actually, about the raid, a very long book that came out earlier this year, a work of history.
Interesting. So, the history is so important, because when we build our organizations, our political and theoretical foundations on these historical institutions or phenomena, I think it's really important to always refer back to them. And I remember during the founding of the Black Radical Congress, you and others played such an instrumental role in making sure the voices of the LGBTQ+ community were there, not just from the standpoint of establishing the listservs, because I think we were probably one of the first organizations to use listservs and the internet to help with the mobilization for the founding, but also, we got to talking about the freedom agenda. That was a piece that, others had definitely come to grips with. And to add the piece about the LGBTQ community, because I think there are times when even Black radicals show a little bit of their homophobia or the heterosexism. And I know this because as a national organizer, I would go across the country and be in spaces where somebody would say, I agree with everything in the freedom agenda except number, and I would always number one, because it was that I'm not comfortable with adding the gay community into the rights of Black folks, of Black liberation. How do you respond to that still? Because I know it still comes up that some other civil rights don't apply to that community. That's only for Black folks.
Yeah, it's really ongoing, and it's really complicated because I am a lesbian. I've been out since the mid-1970s. I've written about lesbian history and culture. I've been involved in organizing, but what's important is my politics as a person, who is an internationalist, who is a part of the left, who's anti-capitalist, and of course anti-racist, that it's not just about identity, you know. It's about, like, how does sexism and misogyny tie into how we feel about people who have different gender identities or different sexuality? There is a connection there. And some people don't want to go there. They don't want to deal with that. And I don't want to get too into the weeds about any theory or anything. But there's a lot of anxiety in our society about, you know, what's a man, what's a woman, you know, what are black people supposed to do, how are black people different from our oppressors, et cetera, and everything gets all mixed up. I think that the reason that our organizing in the Black Radical Congress, which was one of my most memorable organizing experiences, and so glad that it gave us an opportunity, you and me, to meet, you know, that was 1998. It seems like yesterday, and yet it's time ago. But one of the reasons that it worked is that we had some basic shared understandings about, like, what's the source of the problem here, right. You know? It was a Black Radical Congress, so we were critical of capitalism and of racial capitalism. We definitely were critical and opposed and have worked, you know, our entire lives to topple white supremacy. We had some basic understandings. We understood that there was a connection between racial exploitation and economic exploitation. And the thing is, not everybody who has the identity of being queer, which is now the term that is often used for the entire community, not everybody shares those politics. So the thing is that there are people who have the identity and they are, you know, they're just going along with the okie doke, you know, of the establishment. They're not necessarily critical. They just want it, you know. And it really depends on what kind of politics people have, and also not just what politics they have, what politics they practice and live that makes it possible to build those coalitions. Often, you know, we're isolated. People don't get to know and meet each other. I've had people say to me when I talk about the things that I think are politically important, they will say, well, I never knew that people like you thought that. It's like, well, what did you think I thought? And of course, they see the stuff on TV or, you know, wherever they're getting their information from, and it's just a very different thing than, no, I live in a Black community. The community I represented on the Common Council, that's what we call it in Albany, the Common Council, but it is the City Council. That community was a predominantly working poor Black community. That's where I lived, you know, for many years. And I guess I could have lived somewhere else, but I did not wish to live anywhere else. You know, I'd always lived in primarily or predominantly people of color communities, so, you know, that was not different. That was not a different choice. But as I said, people don't really understand necessarily what one is involved in when they find out that there's one thing about you that's different. Your sexuality. And I love history, even though, like, you know, what I studied, you know, in school was literature. But the thing is, you can't really separate Black literature from Black history. It's not possible. But the thing is that there have always been people in our African community, our African diaspora, both in on the African continent and elsewhere, who have had different sexual orientations and different gender identities. That has always been the case. It may not be the terms that are used to describe that may not be the same ones that are used now. But when one goes back in history, you see that there's a continuum, and that in some of those communities, people were not ostracized. They were actually functioning parts of cohesive communities that all served, you know, for the health of the community to go forward.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think a statement that needs to probably be reiterated time and time again, because I'm thinking about, as you were talking, I do believe it was the collective that popularized the term intersectionality. And so when you're talking about black queer folks and how is it that people see them outside of civil rights, it's really, in retrospect, you know, pretty unbelievable, because as you said, we have multiple identities, you know. So if you don't deserve civil rights as a black queer poor person,
right.
Who does get civil rights?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And trans black women are the most targeted of all trans people and people who are gender non-conforming, etc. In other words, who are the most targeted mm-hmm. people around their gender identity, you know, and their sexual, perhaps their sexual expression, because those are two different things.
Right.
But like, who's the most targeted? It's black transgender women who are poor and who are subject to all kinds of violence, including murder, because of who they are. And we don't necessarily, we can make decisions about what kind of values we have, but we don't necessarily choose things as profound as our sexual orientation, our sexuality, our gender, you know, identity. We don't necessarily choose that. Most people, and many people would be surprised to find out, that only a few decades ago, that if a woman came out as a lesbian, her husband or the father of her children could take those children away.
Automatically.
And I have friends for whom that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts stood with that removal.
Exactly.
Barbara,
why do you think that black trans are so offensive to people? Why are they so targeted?
I think that people, as I said, are nervous. I don't know if that's the right word. People are very conflicted around sexuality. I think maybe not everywhere, but certainly in a country that began with, you know, well, with separate colonialism and genocide, you know, of the indigenous people who lived here, and then the, you know, the history of chattel enslavement. This country is built on, you know, horror, absolute unjustifiable horror. And then there were the Puritans, you know, and there are other strains that you know, stole the country. There are other people who came here from Europe and stole the country who also have conservative values. Living in upstate New York, as I do, I didn't really realize this until I moved here. But the Dutch were quite conservative. So you had the Puritans, you had the Dutch, you had different churches, and, you know, all kinds of things going on. So people are kind of conflicted. I think that, yeah, I just saw a wonderful movie about a adolescent young person, the summer before they go to high school, and it was so touching because, and I think the name of the movie is Duty, and the person was, it was so touching because all those things that we all went through, you know, as young teenagers and as teenagers, it was really a beautiful story told, you know, through this film. And I was thinking, yeah, it was just like everything was just happening. Things were so confusing, you know. And I think that, yeah, we hold on to that. And one of the ways that we kind of establish ourselves is that we make, like, this, you know, certain decisions or certain things are true, then we don't have to think about it anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the reasons that trans people are so upsetting to others who are hostile is because people who are trans make decisions, you know, about actually manifesting who they know themselves to be. So gender is fluid, you know, it's not like cut and dry, you know, that you can, you're assigned a certain gender at birth, but things might not be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You may not feel that, you know. And it's interesting that their children, you know, their actual, their minor children, were letting their parents know who they feel themselves to be. And if they have parents that are open and accepting, they will be allowed to, as opposed to being put away, you know, or, you know, just
a forced to go to some kind of conversion therapy.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so that makes some people very unsettled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I just feel like, if it's not affecting you and your family, why are you concerned about it? You know.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Why can't you let, you know, Miss Green over here and Mr. James over there and whoever the people are, why can't you just let them have their lives? And then you do what you wish to do within your own community or your own family. I mean, there's a song, I can't remember, is it a Ma Rainey song? I can't remember which one of the great blues women it is, but it ain't nobody's business if I do. You know, it's like, just get out of my business. I'm not bothering you. Please don't bother me.
And I would say probably of any sector in our community, it is the queer community that is the least violent towards other sectors. I mean, really, if you're talking about somebody that you need to be fearing, I think it's, you know, young white men. So, young white straight men.
I mean, statistically.
Right. Statistically, that is the, yeah. That's the reality of it. And so it always, like, puzzles me when I look at the fact that black trans women are, the death rate is like off the charts, and like, why do we see them as such a threat? Why do we see that as such a repulsive kind of reality when, you know, at one point, and this is not to say that we should go back to that, you know, men loving men was also offensive, but seems like there's been a shift to the trans women as opposed to, like you said, let people love who they want to love. Life is
right.
Life is too short. And so here we are trying to really defend who people can love. It seems like a really backwards
how they kind can of live the world, how they can live in the world with joy.
Right, exactly. I mean, the fact that we are doing that in a civilized society in 2024, it's shameful. It really is.
Right, and there's a class dimension to this, too, because employment and economic survival are factors that are affected by one's gender presentation, one's sexuality, etc. You know, like being put out of your house, for example. You know, either as a youth, being put out by your family members, or a landlord not renting to you because they don't like your type of, you know, the type of person that you are. Trying to find employment if you don't conform to what they think you should be wearing. But as RuPaul said, you come out, you know, you're born naked. Everything else from that point on is drag. And I love that. I really love that. That's a great concept. I think about it, you know, as I wear my little, you know, academic type, you know, outfit, you know.
But see, I call them uniforms for certain situations. We put on our uniform.
I just fall into that. What is a black woman of my age, you know, who was raised, you know, conservatively, what does that person wear these days?
Go redesign that for yourself. Well, I got one more thing about the collective statement, and then I have a few key questions for you, because one of the things in the collective is a quote that came right out of The Nationalist Woman, which was written by the Menominees of the Committee for Unified Newark. I was in the Congress of African People, and the reason that this resonates is because I had been asked to write, like, how do I come into a being a political being, and sort of I have to start with CAP, because, well, not start with, but that was a big part of how I got radicalized, and where all my organizing training came from. And I read that thing again, and I tell you, I was like, shame. You talk about this building the wall of shame. I'm like, man, I can't believe we said that in 1971. But that was real for nationalist women, because it came right out of that whole patriarchy thing about serving men. And particularly that piece about the men are gold and the women are silver. I'm like, damn.
Right.
What kind of stuff is that? So luckily, here's the thing though, Barbara, luckily, if you keep studying and you keep growing, you're going to shed that particular skin. And so we came into the light as Mumaninas and Malikas of the Congress of African People, and went on to challenge patriarchy, went on to convene women for the National Black United Front, and then moved on to really a full-fledged attack on patriarchy. So I'm saying that because you don't always have to stay in the same place. So yes, right, that was shameful what we wrote in 1971, but that was what we were thinking at that particular time. But we thank goodness for the collective and other folks who were already embracing feminism, already connecting it with, you know, our African spirit, our African personality. And thank goodness we moved away from that whole thing that somehow men are superior to women. Jesus, I don't know, every time I read that, I'd like, man, I'm so glad we moved away from that. So here's another question for you, Barbara. I remember you did a piece for the New York Times back in 2019, and the reason I remember it so well was for a number of reasons. One of them, it was written, at least published, June 19th, which was the founding of Black Radical Congress, some 20 years before that. But this was an article in which you were saying, here's why I'm leaving the mainstream movement, and, you know, with no regrets. So talk about what led you to that, because that's now been a few years, but you had not been involved in that for a number of years, the mainstream queer movement. But I do want to tell people that, because I think it's related, that there were a number of folks of color, mainly Black folks, who brought you to St. Louis for Pride Month some years ago.
Yes.
And you were the first person of color to have been a keynote speaker. And I can tell you, we were just joyful that we were able to get you to come, because we thought then it was going to mean some breakthroughs for this predominantly white, you know, movement here, and
right,
it's predominantly white in most places. And so, and the other thing is that there's always this sort of parallel Black Pride thing that happens because folks don't feel comfortable in the white pride thing. So talk about why you felt like that particular movement was not really meeting your particular needs, but neither was it meeting the needs of other folks of color.
Right. I remember coming to St. Louis then. It was such a wonderful experience, and I'm just so glad that we'll be connecting, you know, through this conversation today, and we're not going to lose contact going into the future. No, I can't. But in any event, when I wrote that article in the New York Times, I had not been involved in the mainstream LGBTQIA+ movement for years before I wrote the article. I actually had kind of gotten out of it probably sometime in the 1990s, because there were national marches on Washington, and the first national march on Washington, just a second, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. If you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, Voices from the Battlefield, and we are talking to Barbara Smith, one of the co-founders of the Black Combahee, or in the South, Combi. Now I can't even say it the way they say it, but I think it is something phonetically going on with the Black folks down there, that they skip that that particular syllable.
And white people, too. They're interviewing white people.
Yeah, but I'm saying, once you've been saying something for so long, everybody's because now, first of all, I'm thinking this is like a Native American name, so it's got to have all the syllables. So yeah, okay. So back to why you left mainstream.
Right, indeed. So as I said, there were marches on Washington. I attended the first national march on Washington for lesbian and gay rights in 1979. I spoke at the one in 87. I think that was a year. That might have been the second one. That was during during the AIDS epidemic, a very somber situation, because it was the first time that the AIDS quilt was displayed on the National Mall, and it just, you know, just a lot of things were going on. And then by the early 90s, the movement had become more and more corporate and more mainstream. And we actually wrote a statement, a group of people of color who wrote a statement about how we were not down with where they were coming from. I think that was the Millennium March or something like that. I may be getting my dates mixed up, because there were several marches. Every few years there'd be a national march. But at a certain point, it's like, no, I can't do this anymore. There's no, like, consciousness about material conditions here. One of the things that was going on in the movement during those years was around gays in the military. Now, being found out to be gay or lesbian in the military up until a certain point meant that you were basically kicked out of the military and you lost all your benefits. Now, that's not fair. It's like, regardless of what you think of military service, if somebody signs up, enlists, and then they're found out not to be cisgender heterosexual, you get kicked out with, like, even a dishonorable discharge. That's not fair. But there were those of us who were critical of imperialism and critical of militarism, and, like, our slogans, our slogan for that, we had more than one. One of the slogans was homosexual, not homicidal.
Whoa.
So, in other words, yes, not fair that people are getting kicked out of the military, which is your source of livelihood, for their sexual identity, but on the other hand, we're not really down with the whole military colonial project. So there are distinctions being made. Nowadays, at some of the major prides, maybe all of them, but certainly in New York City, there are police. And police are a part of the major pride celebration. And of course, New York City Pride, along with San Francisco, those are probably the two largest prides in the United States. And, like, some people don't feel comfortable being in anything where the police are active participants, even if they are gay and lesbian, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
They paint police cards, they paint, and I've seen pictures of this, they paint New York City police cars in rainbow stripes. Does that make it all right?
Mm.
I don't think so.
No. So, but it's interesting when you talk about the corporate kind of wrapping of the mainstream media. I mean, when the group that Billy thought to bring you there, Terry Coates, Jamie Archie, and some of the other folks that have been, most of them moved away from mainstream at that time as well. So
right,
they're losing some of the, I think, some of the most staunchest fighters from that movement when they've done this. Now, this year for White Pride, they had Boeing as one of the sponsors.
Really?
So when you talk about corporate sponsors and the corporatization of mainstream gay movement, so quite naturally they were going to be protesters. So
that's astounding.
So they, you know, they, Boeing, I mean, I don't even know what rock these people are under. But the protesters were there, and rightfully so, and they called the police on them. So I don't, you know, this whole thing about support for gay rights, it makes it very difficult when people see that kind of stuff. Like, you want me to do what? And like you said, just because the car is painted in rainbow, that means I'm not supposed to see these folks as an extension of the oppressive nature of the capitalist system? Really?
And policing.
Yeah.
Well, see, the thing is, that's why we were talking, I was talking about, it's what your politics are. There have always been people of various identities. Let me name James Baldwin as a perfect example, who has stood with struggle. He was a black gay man born in the early 20th century, and he stood with struggle, you know. And he didn't just read about or hear about the civil rights movement. That's what was going on at the time. He went to the South. You know, he was in places where he was in danger. He supported the movement. I'm not saying that he was perfect. He did spend time in Europe, living there, because, as he said, he really couldn't get his writing done, his work done, if he had to deal with the madness and the oppression of white supremacy 24/7. Some people fault him for that. Our great contemporary black gay men who have faulted him for living overseas. And it's like, yeah, but did you try living during Jim Crow in the early 20th century? No, you didn't. So you know,
as an open black,
what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But it's about the politics and the people who have the kind of multi-issued politics. You mentioned the term intersectional earlier. No, we did not coin that term. We talked about interlocking oppressions. It was Kimberly Crenshaw, a legal scholar, who in the late 1980s coined the term intersectionality, which is a quite useful one. Mm-hmm. But we talked about interlocking oppressions in our 1977 Combahee Collective Statement. And for people who have those kind of multi-issued politics, we were never the majority, and we don't get the kind of play and the kind of visibility that some of the other people do, like, say, an Ellen DeGeneres or, you know, somebody like that who's on TV, mm-hmm. and who just basically, as I said before, is going along with the okey-doke. Mm-hmm. But we are here. We exist. You know, Byron Rustin, if not for him, there would have been no 1963 March on Washington. He was an ultimate, you know, organizer. He was a superb organizer, and he did that thing. Now, where did he stand around Israel and around some other issues as time went on? No one is perfect, but the thing is, those of us who have a commitment to struggle and to freedom and liberation, we try to contribute as well as we can. But as I said, we don't get the visibility. We're kind of like under the radar in some ways, and the other people who do get the visibility, they may not be saying much. You know?
Mm-hmm. Of course. And if they are saying anything, it's going to be muffled or not heard at all. So
right, indeed.
But I'm just curious about at what point is the mainstream Pride movement going to recognize that there are people that they are pushing out based on their politics, based on their actions? I mean, you mentioned in the article that political agendas and marriage equality, all this would not solve it, because the basic problem is that they are not addressing the fundamental needs of people who are being unjustly dealt with, and most of those are black people, poor people, or I should say people of color. So mm-hmm. is this going to be just an all-white thing, and they loving every minute of it, and it's just one big party?
I have no idea. I can't really speak to that because having watched, you know, I've been involved since not that many years after Stonewall happened. So I came out in the mid-70s. That was less than a decade after the Stonewall Rebellion, led by black and Latinx people who described themselves at that time as drag queens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about Marsha P. Johnson.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Sylvia Rivera. You know, I'm thinking about Miss Major. You know, I'm thinking about people who fought for that, you know. And that was 69, the Stonewall Inn in New York City. That's usually where the modern movement, that's considered to be the beginning date, you know, 69. I came out in the mid-70s, less than a decade afterwards. I've seen quite a bit of it. I don't know that we will ever be able to sway, you know, the trajectory of the establishment within the LGBTQIA plus community. I don't know that we can do that. Some of us try. There's a National Black Justice Coalition. That's a black organization. There are other organizations that are queer organizations focused upon different ethnic and nationality and racial communities. So, that, you know, the National Black Justice Coalition is one that I'm familiar with. I'm not sure that we'll ever be able to sway them. They are aware that they can't be as all-white as they have been. But at the end of the day, like, I've been doing my work in other places for a long time, and I find that pretty gratifying. And you know, I take a great deal of, you know, just inspiration from being able to work on practical issues with real-life people around things that real-life people need. You know, we were talking about this panhandling, you know, ordinance that may come to the floor in our Albany Town Council. I was just in a meeting for that last night, you know. It was just practical, you know. What can we do? And one of the things we were talking about was, like, how does having a panhandling ordinance for which people then get arrested, and if they can't pay the fine, have to do 15 years in our county jail, how does that affect their access to our housing?
Mm.
And we basically see this thing of, like, people panhandling and being on the street or whatever. It's about houselessness. So we're digging into what's really behind all of these issues, and what do we need to have? You know, do we need to punish poor people who are unhoused, or do we need to have low barrier housing so that people can be housed? You know, we're talking about practical issues. And, you know, I've always been pretty practical myself in my, you know, point of view. I think my background, I did a lot of social science when I was in college. So, you know, I didn't just read like British poets, you know. So the thing is, they're practical things. People need food, shelter, you know, access to free quality medical care. Medical health is a right. Medical care is a right. It should not be a consumer item. There's all these things that people need. How do we get to that? And I really like being able to work on things, as I said, that have practical consequences. And I have found allies in all of the places that I work. And some of the allies, you know, they have different sexual orientations. It's like, I don't care.
Join this army.
Exactly.
Well, like, you know what,
bond around the practicalities of what people
exactly
need.
And is it that particular view that led you to to what I would call another battlefield, and that is, you know, electoral politics, because you did serve as a council person for what, 8 years? Chance to work directly on some of the legislative things, because I'm looking at nationally but also statewide and even locally all the anti-gay legislation that's, you know, it's quite overwhelming. But you're not just dealing with, you know, those pieces of legislation, although I think you probably would, but you're saying all these issues like homelessness, unhoused folks, that affects the general population. Now, sometimes it affects other sectors of the population worse than others, but how did you see yourself being a warrior of human rights when you were serving on the council?
That is an excellent question, and you might not be surprised to find out that what brought me to the council was policing.
Hmm.
Police brutality and police corruption. That's what brought me to the council. We were trying to dig underneath a corrupt and violent police department as a community group. And through that work, people started saying to me, one person in particular started saying to me, well, you know, next year is an election year. You know, like, you know anybody who could run in your ward? I did not decide to run. You know, it was not a career aspiration of mine. I really want to be an elected official. No way. I have no thought. No thought.
No desire whatsoever, huh?
None. Zero. Less than zero. Negative numbers, you know. But the thing is that people approached me, you know. And that's the best way for that to happen, because they wanted somebody to serve. They wanted somebody, of course, you had to live in the community in order to, you know, because it's, our council, is not, citywide or whatever they call it when, you know, you run citywide and you are at large.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
it wasn't
yeah.
at large. You serve a specific district where you reside, you know. So they saw something, you know. I mean, I was out there, like, I love the garden. I only grow flowers. I have flowers right outside of my apartment building right now this summer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and a raised bed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I was out there digging in the dirt, you know, helping, you know, to, you know, plant and take care of a beautiful flower garden in my poor black community. I was doing practical things, you know. A neighbor asked me about getting a disabled sign, you know, parking sign in front of her home. I figured out how to do that, you know. I was doing a lot of the things already that needed to be done, and then when people said, would you consider, I'll support you, I said, oh, okay, okay, maybe, and then but it was really the police issues that brought
mm-hmm.
me to the council,
mm-hmm.
and while I was on the council, I did a lot of different things. I started several community groups, often around youth and educational issues, resources for youth, but a major thing that I worked on was gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, even though we're a small city, you know, we are the capital of New York State, Albany is, but despite the fact that we're a small city, we have disproportionate gun violence, and we worked on that. We did the best we could, and the organization that we were able to put in place, it still functions.
Mm-hmm.
It is still functioning. I haven't been on the council since 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So I often say to people, if you want to see if I did anything, just go by the corner of Henry Johnson and Clinton Avenue. You'll see the office, and that's a snug office. Snug is guns spelled backwards, and it's a public health model of violence interruption that comes out of Chicago. It was called Chicago Ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we put into place. But, you know, that's the kind of work that I did. And I learned so much, Jamala. It was mm-hmm. so wonderful for me to find out about situations and what people were facing, different from what I faced, because I grew up in a lower middle class family. My sister and I, you know, we were only kids. Our mother died very young. I'm a twin, so it was like one birth, two children, and like our family, they wanted us to have a really lovely future, and they knew that was going to happen through school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we did a lot of lovely. They did a lot of lovely things for us. You know, we always had food to eat. We always had clothes to wear. You know, and so a lot of things I have not personally experienced, even though I've struggled financially as a itinerant writer all my life, but those are choices that I make,
mm-hmm.
you know? But the thing is, I found out, you know, I went to so many meetings with mothers and grandmothers to public schools or charter schools about their kids. Can you help me? My kid, you know, my grandchild is having problems at X school, at Y school.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure, I'll go with you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I am comfortable in those kind of context, and that I was a member of the council, you know, like I could get into places just with my business card.
Right, exactly.
But
exactly.
I can't get into now. No, it was a really good experience for me. I did the best that I could. And one of the slogans, I think the first time I ran, it was something like a new voice for our neighborhood, something like that, a new voice for our neighborhood. And then the second time I ran, the slogan on my literature was, I speak up and I get things done.
Mm-hmm.
I speak up and get things
mm-hmm.
done.
Now, were you the first out person on the council?
Now, this is very sad. I was not out when I ran back in the
Okay.
I had to go back in, you know, and I was told that I needed to be out by people very high up, you know, in political, you know, strategy, you know, circles. I was told. And I said, nope, not going to do it because I want to win. you know, I really want to win. I'm not running to prove anything, you know, in advance. I want to win. I'm running, because we had the first black person who was out, was elected in the city of Albany, maybe about a decade before I ran. But he did not run from the community where I lived. He ran from like our kind of hip, upscale community. So it was different, right?
Right.
And so looking at all of that, I said no. And I really hated it. It was very painful, but I thought it was the right decision. And I said, when I get elected, if I get elected, then I'm going to do things once I'm in office where I can bring forward these politics. And that's exactly what I did. I got elected, and then whenever there was an opportunity to speak out, I did not avoid any opportunities to speak out during the time I served. And the second time I ran, 4 years later, I was endorsed by the Victory Fund, which is a national PAC for supporting lesbian and gay candidates. So I wasn't hiding anything by then because I was an incumbent.
Right. But we talk about opportunities. I'm just looking, going forward at the various movements that don't seem to be intersecting too well. I mean, I really am trying to look at, for example, how does the radical black community interface with mainstream? I mean, even sometimes the black pride stuff, it seems to be just a big party, and folks are really trying to understand, how do we make these connections politically so that we can work on issues that affect a broader, you know, community, broader population? So what is your thinking as you look ahead, like, you know, 5-10 years down the line, how the queer community is going to grow and address the issues internally, first of all, internally, and then how are they going to be in community with other sectors of the community around issues that are deemed important?
Well, not to be pessimistic, I don't know if what you're describing will ever quite happen in the way that you are imagining it. But from my perspective, the best leadership, the best queer leadership exists in other movements, like the effort to end the genocide in Palestine, in Gaza. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
In
yes,
other
I do.
Words, when you look at the student encampments, when you look at, you know, who's at the forefront of this organizing to stop a genocide in our lifetime, slaughter, you know, in Gaza, it's almost a whole year now. Next month it will be a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
About 1 month away from now, because of course the catalytic incident happened on October the 7th. But as I said, the leadership of people I encounter in the anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinian liberation movement, the queer people I meet there, those are the leaders. The people I meet who are working on housing, the people who are speaking out about police brutality and for abolition, the people who are speaking about reproductive freedom and bodily autonomy for everyone, which includes queer and trans people, that's where the leadership is. And maybe one day the mainstream movement will catch up with us, you know, but whether it does or not, the work is being done and the work is making a difference. And that's how I see it, you know. I don't see, like, beating my head or anybody beating their head against the wall and trying to get in a door that people are not going to open for you. Find your people wherever they are and do the work.
I think that is so almost prophetic, Barbara. And in the last few minutes of the show, I just really want people to understand what you said. You may not find your political home where you think it is, but you can find people who support your issues on another front.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. And I didn't mention anything about the environment, about global warming, mm-hmm. and the climate crisis, which is too real. It is real. I didn't think I would ever live to actually be affected by it, but the last two summers, deeply affected by it. You know, up here, this is upstate New York. You know, this is not hot like New York City is hot in the summer, and yet our summers are becoming unmanageable
mm-hmm.
because of climate change. That's another place that wonderful younger people, various ages, people of various sexual orientations and gender identities are working. The work is going on.
And I think that is the beauty of it, that it's integrated in such a way that you are not representing a particular identity. You know, you are working with folks around a particular issue. That's what's bringing you together. At some point, Barbara, that the folks in these white groups, so they're going to be like marginalized because they have no relevance other than throwing a big party with the police.
Well, we'll see what happens. We'll have to stay tuned, won't we?
Yes, we will. Thank you, Barbara, for joining me today. Barbara Smith, you are phenomenal. You are a phenomenal sister.
Get out.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are going, we got to have you on again. So Dave, you said stay tuned. And I think that, if you want to hear this program again or you miss parts of it, go to JamalaRogers.com and you will, you can find that one as well as other ones. But, you know, we got so much, y'all, to work on. So pick one thing and double down, find some folks to work with you. But this is Jamala Rogers, your host. And we will see you on the battlefield.